This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news. To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the mouth.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, joining me this week, you can read him in USA Today, Jeff Zilgit, the senior NBA writer for USA Today. What's up, Jeff?
Hey, Chris. Not much. How are you doing?
Thanks for doing this, man. Yeah. We are both on the road recording this from the lovely lobby of a Cleveland hotel, a place that you and I have both been far too many times. And it looks, I don't want to say we're going to be back in the next week or two, but man, after watching Saturday night, that was impressive, what we saw from the Cavaliers.
So we probably talked about this when I was leaving the arena after game two. We become a prisoner of the moment.
Yeah.
And Boston looked unbeatable, had dominated six of the eight quarters, figured they would take their show on the road, and Cleveland, you know, puts up a little roadblock right there. I don't know if we're going to be back here for the finals here in Cleveland, but I think we'll be back here for a game six, unless Boston somehow figures out how to win game four on the road. And we've talked about it, is they've not been good on the road in the playoffs. I know Brad Stevens said it was a small sample size and everything, but it is, the sample size is what it is now, and they've been demonstrably better at home than on the road. All the numbers prove it, your regular statistics, your advanced statistics, player performances. And if the Cavaliers found a little bit of, you know, something offensively and defensively they can carry over, I wouldn't be surprised if we're going back 2-2. And that changes the whole dynamics. Instead of making it that Cleveland had to win 4 or 5, which was the case before game three, now you've just reduced it to a best 2 of 3, and both teams are in the same boat.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so what happened in game three? Because, you know, you always get a team's best shot in game three. A team in a 2-0 hole, they always give you their best punch. Milwaukee did it to Boston. They ran over them in the first round. I expected Boston to lose game three. I didn't expect them to get as beaten badly as they were. I mean, this was a game that was effectively over 5 minutes in. When Jaylen Brown picked up that second foul and you saw Brad Stevens going to the bench for Gershon Yabusele, who had played 9 total minutes prior to the start of this game, going to Greg Monroe early on for big minutes, you knew that they were grasping at straws there. What happened to Boston in game three? And I guess more to the point, what changed for Cleveland?
Making shots. Ty Lue probably doesn't like this at all, and any coach out there doesn't like it. But the Cavaliers are better defensively when shots are going in, and they give more of an effort defensively. It was probably LeBron's best defensive effort of the playoffs last night in game three. And
he took Jaylen Brown out of that game early on. And Jaylen Brown is one of the best first quarter players Boston has.
And that was part of their MO. And so when that happens, in turn, they put the defense on their heels when they're going back down the court. LeBron is in the open court. He has space. He's finding his mismatches. He could go one-on-one. It started off with the three-pointers, George Hill, J.R. Smith, LeBron driving to the bucket. Then when Boston started cutting off the three-pointers, LeBron started picking them apart with the pick-and-roll with Larry Nance Jr. and Tristan Thompson. That, in turn, opened up the three-point line again for Kyle Korver, Kevin Love, J.R. Smith again. And so that was the dynamic. And the point being is that when Cleveland's defense is getting stops, they're more motivated. It leads to better offense, as opposed to where I think Boston, in general, gives the same amount of effort defensively, whether they're up 20 or down 20. It doesn't impact how they play. It clearly impacts how Cleveland plays. And for at least game three, all those things went in the right direction. It snowballed. The game got out of hand. It was 19 in the first quarter, 20 by the second quarter, and then in the second half we got up to 30. But that's what happened. Cleveland, it may not be the prettiest of offenses all the time. Not like Houston's, not like Golden State's, But when they're scoring like that, making 50% of their threes, they have one of the best offenses in the league.
It has to drive Cavs fans crazy to watch them play like that because, you know, they go the whole first round. Indiana largely outplays them in that series. They squeak out a win thanks to LeBron's greatness. But when they're engaged defensively and they're getting a diversity of offense, six guys scored in double figures in this one. They're unbeatable, at least in the Eastern Conference. Like, Boston has to look at this, and there's a lot the Celtics can do. We'll get into that. But when the Cavaliers play like that, it almost doesn't matter what their opponents in the Eastern Conference do because they're too tough to beat.
What was it last night? LeBron, George Hill, J.R. Smith, Kevin Love, Kyle Korver each had 5 3-pointers. Or, I'm sorry, 3 3-pointers.
17 overall.
I mean. Yeah, so they're 17 to 34. When those guys are getting multiple threes, LeBron didn't miss a three. You know, J.R.'s jacket, 28-foot, like – that is the best J.R. Smith. And again, I agree with you. It has to drive the fans crazy. It's got to drive Ty Lue crazy at times because if you exert that effort defensively when things aren't going your way offensively, it stands to reason that's going to turn for you a little bit. Now, in games 1 and 2, maybe no matter what they did defensively, it was going to work for Boston and everything. And we'll see. You know, they made some changes, getting Tristan into the starting lineup. I know it didn't end in a result in game 2, but it certainly made a difference on how Al Horford has played. And so, you know, they've figured a couple things out. But being a prisoner of the moment, I fully expect Brad Stevens and his staff to come up with some counters for game 4, and we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, that's the question. What is more likely, Cleveland playing at that same level or Boston playing at the low level that it played? And I would say that Boston playing better is far more likely because they've done that all postseason. Like, they haven't been, you know, against Milwaukee, go back to that series where they got run in game 3. They lost game 4, but they lost by a bucket. They lost a heartbreaking style at the end of that game. I think they bounced back, but their offense looked just, I don't know what it was. That was not what I'm used to seeing from the Celtics. What you're used to seeing from the Celtics is a lot of ball movement, a lot of passing. I'm watching Marcus Smart go one-on-one over and over and over again. I'm watching Terry Rozier take mid-range jump shots. This Celtics team is not a mid-range jump shooting team, and they were almost outside their bodies in this one. I don't know, you know, Jeff, if they... did they come into this game thinking, like, we can just mail this one in? Like, you know, I don't know if the intensity just wasn't there for Boston.
Those mid-range jumpers were the ones that stood out to me, and even early in the game, absolutely. And that's going to play into Cleveland's hands a little bit. So I expect that to change a little bit as well. I went to practice. You know, can we see a lineup change? You know, I think that's possible.
Do you go bigger? Do you go back to Baines?
I think you do. And make Baines and Horford beat up Tristan and Kevin Love. You know, don't make it so easy. Take Tristan out of the paint a little bit. Put Kevin Love and make Al Horford, you know, go one-on-one against Kevin Love. Maybe even switch it up so that LeBron has to guard Al Horford a little bit. That could open up stuff for Jaylen Brown as we're talking. So that's what I think they're going to do. Brad Stevens is a little coy, as usual, on his lineup decision. But that could be one alternative to switching it up for game 4 and see what happens.
So who do you pull out of the starting lineup then? Marcus Morris?
That would be the one. Yeah. I mean, he was the one who goes into the starting lineup, and so he would be the one. And maybe that does give the bench a little something, you know, helps them spread the floor if they're going to be able to spread the floor. And, you know, the Cavs have done it. They put Kyle Korver on the bench in game 3, bring him in as a reserve with Tristan starting. Kyle Korver has generally been pretty good the last 2 games. I know he didn't score the second half of game 3, had all 11 of his points in the first half, but he was pretty good last night from 3-point range, ends up with 14 points. And, you know, he's another one. When he's on the floor, I'll have to go look at the numbers. But when it's LeBron, Love, Korver, JR, and Tristan, I think they put up some pretty good offensive numbers, and they're just fine enough defensively. Going back to that point you were making, I expect Boston to be better. Maybe Cleveland continues to shoot that well, which is a possibility. They did it against Toronto. But what I expect is the game to be a lot closer, more like games 1 and 3 of that Toronto-Cleveland series than what we saw in game three in Cleveland, you know, blowing out.
And I think that's important for Boston. I think they can still win this series if it's 2-2 going back home. I don't think they win this series if it's 2-2 and it's back-to-back blowout losses. I think once that happens, even though they're a different team at home, I don't know why, but they're a different team at home. But that sucks some of the confidence out of you. Like, that takes a little bit of the life out of you, especially when you're going home and you have the prospect of now in a best out of three against the best player in the world, against the team that's been to three straight NBA finals. I think that is a bridge too far for a team this young.
And that's where it starts to become problematic, the team being too young. And I think at a certain point, now there is that idea that they don't know what they don't know, and maybe that works in their advantage at a certain point. But if it turns into a blowout in game four, they head back to Boston, maybe some of that doubt starts to creep in a little bit, like we saw with the Raptors. No matter what the Raptors did, they couldn't beat Cleveland. And maybe those young guys start to think about that a little bit more, get the idea that, hey, maybe Cleveland has figured something out.
Some of the core guys on this team have been beaten by Cleveland the last few years. They haven't been playing as big a role. I mean, Jaylen Brown was there last year. Terry Rozier's been there the last few years. Al Horford's been there the last few years. So it's not like these guys don't know what it feels like
Marcus
to get beat.
Marcus Smart,
same thing. Like, they're now in enhanced roles, but they know how tough it is to get by LeBron.
And maybe the deeper it goes, that idea that they don't, maybe those young guys, Brown and Tatum, start to figure out what they do know. And boy, this gets really difficult to beat LeBron. And I've said it, we all say it, as vulnerable as a Cavs team looks every year, and no more vulnerable than they were down 2-0 just a couple days ago, we're going to stick with this theory. Beating LeBron James four times in the Eastern Conference playoffs is incredibly difficult to do.
Yeah, I agree. I think we have to, too, give Ty Lue some credit for what he did in this game, because he's been viewed as the lesser of the two coaches in this series. Look, some of it's justifiable. I thought he made some questionable decisions when the series was in Boston. But the adjustment he made on Jaylen Brown, I mean, that was an excellent coaching tactic in that one. Horford, too. I mean, just staying at home on Horford throughout the course of that game, that kept Horford from being as involved offensively as he usually is. I thought Ty Lue had a terrific coaching game.
He did, and it's one of these, I'm not sure that how much Ty Lue gets caught up in that, but every coach in the NBA, especially when you get this deep in the playoffs, they want to be recognized for the moves they make. And he may have realized that he wasn't at his best in games one and two, but you hit on all the points, LeBron making life difficult for Jaylen Brown, the Tristan Thompson decision, Brandon Korver off the bench has helped out with that second unit. Again, Jeff Green, he's still struggling a little bit. I know Larry Nance picked it up. Jordan Clarkson gave him some okay minutes in game four, but Korver does give him a lift off the bench. That works out. Offensively, they knew coming out of game two that they needed more player movement. Now, it's not a team known for tons of player movement when they run offense. It's see what LeBron does at the top of the key, maybe get some pin downs and some curls for a three-point shooter. But I thought they had better player movement in game four, and I think that made life easier on LeBron. And George Hill, if he's going to contribute like that, that really takes some pressure.
He was great the first quarter. He set the tone. He didn't finish with great numbers overall, shooting numbers, but he set the tone that first quarter.
And that's where the game was won, right there. And so he's hitting threes. He was driving to the bucket. And so when those things happen, it makes Cleveland really difficult to beat.
Support for the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. They understand that home plays a big role in your life and family. That's why they created Rocket Mortgage. Rocket Mortgage gives you the confidence you need when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. It's simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. Whether you're looking to buy your first home or your 10th, with Rocket Mortgage, you get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. It's convenient. Our trusted partners allow you to share your financial information with Rocket Mortgage at the touch of a button. And in addition to getting a real mortgage approval in minutes, you can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you're getting the right solution for you. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Apply simply, understand fully, mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states,
NMLSConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
All right, let's talk about a couple other things. Yep. Mike Budenholzer is headed to Milwaukee to be the head coach of the Bucks. A little bit of a back-and-forth battle between Toronto and Milwaukee for it. The Raptors ultimately didn't make an offer to Budenholzer, but they were interested. The Bucks get him. How much of an impact do you think a Mike Budenholzer has in Milwaukee?
Let's go back to look at his first couple years in Atlanta, and I think that's what we're going to compare this to. Maybe not exactly the same level of talent, but what he figured out how to do was, and he has talent in Milwaukee, but that Atlanta team, and Chris, help me out if I miss a name here, Jeff Teague, Al Horford, Paul Millsap, Kyle Korver, who's the last guy?
Is Damari Carroll part of that group?
Damari Carroll was part of it, kept Bazemore a little bit off the bench, and so he took those guys, made him a really good defensive unit. He's going to have to do the same with that. But then he's going to have to implement some of that ball-sharing offense that, you know, probably is a direct descendant of the San Antonio Spurs. That's where Budenholzer was an assistant for a long, long time. And figure out how to make that offense a lot better. Start maximizing potential of a Jabari Parker. We see what's possible with Giannis Antetokounmpo. Continue that. I mean, we talked about Giannis in MVP terms at times this season. Let's see if we can actually get him. That's what Mike Budenholzer has to do. Can we get him to that MVP level? You know, Chris Middleton, you saw it in that Boston series. He was really, really good, very efficient. So let's maximize that. Can they get another three-point shooter or two on that squad? And so that's what I'm really looking forward to. You mentioned the Toronto going after Budenholzer a little bit. I think it's more of an upgrade for Milwaukee to get Budenholzer than it was for Toronto to get Budenholzer, considering they had Dwayne Casey. And I thought this would have been bad optics as well. This wasn't the primary reason Dwayne was fired, but he couldn't beat the Cavs and LeBron James. Well, Mike Budenholzer was 0-8. Against LeBron James and the Cavaliers. So it's not exactly like he had solved how to beat the best player.
No, that would have been the narrative.
Yes. Like,
you know, you're replacing a guy that couldn't beat LeBron with the last guy before him that couldn't beat LeBron.
I mean, he's been running them off, Tom Thibodeau, Doc Rivers. I mean, he's just chasing guys.
He's a coach killer, except not in the traditional way that we say.
Luckily, Brad Stevens, we'll see what happens in the series, seems to be set for the future, and Danny's not going to make a decision.
It'd be his Brad Stevens' third year of getting beat by
yes,
by
it
LeBron.
Would. I mean, he's at Frank Vogel.
Yeah.
Forgot about him during the Indiana days as well. So he takes care of running
he's got,
coaches
like, heads
off.
Mounted in his...
That's exactly it. Some plaques. And some of those guys were coaches of the year as well. And so I like Budenholzer in Milwaukee. I think he's excited. The press conference coming up soon. But I think he's going to hit on some of those topics that we're addressing right here, how to be better offensively and defensively. I honestly thought that Milwaukee, and maybe I was a little – over-aggressive and thinking how good they were going to be this past season. But I thought they had the capability to be a top-four team in the East. I thought they were going to move into that Washington Wizards level of a four seed, and that didn't happen. I think that's possible. But now we also have to look at Philadelphia is obviously entrenched in there. Boston is. We'll see what happens with Cleveland. Indiana is so much better than we thought. So Milwaukee has some work to do to get into that top four.
Yeah, I like the hire because – you know, Budenholzer is a tactician, right? I mean, he's one of the smarter coaches and doesn't get beat, you know, by another coach all that often. He gets beat by LeBron, but he's not going to get outcoached all that often. I am interested to see what he does with Giannis, though, in that offense like you talked about. I mean, Giannis was doing a lot of one-on-one in the postseason. And look, he put up some great numbers, but you don't win. Nobody wins anywhere by playing one-on-one all the time. Like, let's see how Giannis reacts in that Budenholzer pass-happy offense, a lot of ball movement. Can they create mismatches for him? I think Giannis is organically going to go to another level next year because he works as hard as any young player that I've seen. I'd be interested to see if, you know, and I don't know what the staffing looks like right now in Milwaukee, but, you know, Sean Sweeney's been working pretty closely with Giannis over the years. He was part of Jason Kidd's staff. Do they keep him around to keep working with Giannis? I think that could be a good move for Budenholzer. But, you know, what he can do with this group, because Milwaukee, it's a
good job right now. In the next couple of years, I don't know what it's going to be. They're still going to have Giannis in that mix, but you've got Parker who's going to demand some decent money this offseason. Yep. You got Bledsoe coming up after next year. You got Malcolm Brogdon looming out there for a new contract. I mean, they could be in that kind of salary cap hell that teams don't want to be in before they, you know, for the next couple of seasons.
Yeah, and then, Chris, you mentioned that. Okay. Then after a couple of years, they're going to be looking at Giannis's next contract.
And he's going to look, he's talking loyalty now, but you never know. When a guy's 25, 26 years old and his team's not winning and you're about to be an unrestricted free agent, it's like with Kawhi. You don't know who's in his ear. You don't know who's telling Giannis over the next couple of years what's happening.
And Chris, let's just be look at what's happening around the league. That idea of a guy, I mean, even LeBron didn't stick with the same team. And again, the idea... We've seen it. Dirk's the last one who's going to do that, play for a team. If that a guy who's an MVP caliber player play for a team his entire career. Kobe did it. I thought Dwayne Wade was going to be it, and even he didn't do it. But look at the guys after that second deal is over, a Kevin Durant type, LeBron, Dwight Howard, DeMarcus Cousins. They just don't stay with that team. And so I know – they don't like to hear about it in Milwaukee, but to a certain degree, they're on the clock to figure out how to win right now, go deeper into the playoffs. They don't have a series win with Giannis. And to your point, he's going to look around. And I always feel that a player owes it to himself to do such a thing as well, but to see what else is out there. And, you know, so you're mentioning the coaching staff. I think Bud's got a great reputation as a player development guy. His staff does that kind of work, and whether or not they keep showing Sweeney or not, they at least have the reputation of making players better.
And they're in, you know, you mentioned they're on the clock, and even if they're able to keep a good group together, like Toronto, they ran to Cleveland year after year, right? Like that was their, blockade to get to the finals. Boston could be the same thing for Milwaukee and for Philadelphia, for that matter. These are good teams with star players, but the Celtics just beat the Bucks, and they're going to get appreciably better next year when they get their two All-Stars back. The Celtics just, gentlemen, swept the Sixers, and who's the better team out of that group next year, barring a LeBron James, you know, defection or a Kawhi Leonard type of trade? You know, these two teams... You know, they've got the star power at the top, but if they don't get measurably better over the next couple of years, they're going to run into a Celtics team which is built to have sustainable Eastern Conference success.
And then it's going to be on the general manager there, John Horst, who, you know, again.
Brian Colangelo in Philly. Like, they're going to, there's a lot of pressure on those two guys in the next couple of years.
And look, I think John's a smart guy and probably has a pretty solid plan, but. You could have that plan, and the guys you feel that are necessary to take you to the next level, you either don't get them, they don't turn out. I mean, just, Chris, I don't know what you thought, but the idea, you know, that Jay Crowder, regardless of what you thought of that Celtics-Cavs trade at the time, getting Jay Crowder, you know, you thought was going to be something, a 3-and-D guy for the Cavs. That didn't work out like that. And those are targeted guys that teams like. And it doesn't always work out. So, again, going to be watching what they do. But getting back to your original question, they should be – the Bucks should be happy that they got Bud. Bucks fans should be excited about it. And whether or not they get to where we think they should be, they're going to be a better team next year.
Let me finish with this. Yep. The Supreme Court ruled on sports gambling, right? They said that states can legalize it if they want to. The expectation is that we're going to see a rash of states in the coming months, you know, New Jersey probably first, legalize sports gambling. The sports leagues out there have weighed in on it to some degree with some statements there. The NBA has always been kind of at the forefront of this, as they are on a lot of different topics. I don't know exactly how they respond to it, but I would imagine of the four major sports leagues, Jeff, that the league is going to be first in trying to harness that and make money off it. What did you think about, you know, the NBA's, how they respond to sports gambling?
Yeah, well, and we go back to when the Supreme Court started hearing this case and the NBA, you know, making arguments in New York courts that they want that 1% of all monies wagered on NBA games. So they're looking to profit to a certain degree. If the league hears this, they're going to shoot back and say, we're looking to ensure that everything is on the up and up. They want regulation. They want to make sure anyone who's wagering knows that there's no funny business going on. But let's not discard that there's profit involved. I don't know if they'll end up getting that 1%, but I bet you they do get some cut out of it. And maybe 1% they were shooting high. You hit on it. Adam's been at the forefront of it. They've done a lot of studies of how they bet soccer in Europe, Australia, whether it's in Australia, whether it's tennis, cricket, Aussie rules football, whatever the case may be, and paying attention to how people gamble, the ways they do it. I mean, I don't know how soon it's going to be, but we or people are going to be able to do it on their phone at halftime of a game and tons of prop bet situation. Who gets the first bucket?
Well, that was what I was wondering too. Do you make it part of the in-arena experience, right? Like, could you have like arenas where it's set up that you can bet on each quarter and you can bet on the half and you can bet prop bets, like you say, because if they do that, they can make a killing.
I think people going to games,
they're going to be willing to bet on stuff.
Of course, it's going to be fun. And even if it's a small wager, you know, the cost of a beer, and it, you know, there's going to be people willing to do that. I look at it this way, you know, not everyone, but a majority of people who go to an NBA game are generally going to have a little expendable income to do what we're talking about right there. That's not the case for every single person. And so, yes, I do envision that. And I want to think I'm thinking about this correctly, is that Adam has mentioned that that's what they do in European soccer and at Wembley Stadium or wherever they are, to be able to do those kinds of bets in-game. And whether it's at a kiosk, whether I think they're far more advanced in Europe where you can do it over your phone. But at a kiosk, ensure that it gets done in time. You know, there's not a lag with your connection or anything like that. But, yeah, Chris, I absolutely see that coming at some point. Now, how soon they get there, maybe they just start off slow. Let's do some prop bets before the game, you know, money line, the spread, that kind of stuff. But I certainly see it getting there.
Some of the perceptions of gambling have been kind of washed away over the years. Particularly, you know, remember 10 years ago, who would have thought we'd have a team in Vegas? Yep. I mean, there was always that narrative that, well, you put a team in Vegas, maybe a point shaving, you know, the presence of all that gambling could lead to some kind of scandal. Well, the NHL seems to be doing fine there. The NFL is planning to go there. Even the WNBA is going to be out there in this coming season. Do you think that there's any danger in having, you know, in heavily involving gambling in arenas in the NBA the way that they could?
I think less in the NBA, or maybe in general, less in pro sports. College sports, I think, might have a bigger issue, especially with how we look at college football and basketball. There's
teenagers
all
that don't make any money.
Yeah, so it's exactly what we're talking about, how to pay players at the college level. And if you look at that, and I don't want to sound like I'm a 50s gangster, but if you look at some of the
you kind of have the look of a 50s gangster. People don't notice. Like, go Google Jeff.
And so if you look at that and, you know, what happened in that era, you could certainly see in someone be susceptible to that with the amount of money that NBA guys are paid. But also, you mentioned the WNBA. I know a lot of them do go overseas to play, but they are not making millions in the WNBA the same way that they are. But that's one reason the NBA is very interested in having some kind of oversight and drawing. You know, they're going to have to hire lots of people who are monitoring this, watching the lines, watching the games. You and I may have to watch games a little differently sometimes. Oh boy, that was an odd shot to take. You know, that I think those things are going to come up. What we even see it now, whether it's a football or basketball game, you know, when someone closes out the end of a game and hits a random three-pointer that changes the spread or the outcome of that. And so those are things that are all going to be looked at, but less so with the NBA just because the guys make so much money. And yeah, I just think there's less inclination to do that.
I agree with that. I think one reason, though, when you talked about the NBA kind of slow playing a little bit, starting off with some small things before the game and whatever, I think they have to be wary of the fact that the last major gambling scandal in pro sports happened on their watch. Yeah. I mean, Tim Donaghy still
is a pretty big stain on the NBA's resume. Now, since then, they haven't had any problems. Since then, they seem to have cleaned up, you know, some of their practices there in terms of monitoring these guys. But, you know, a referee can still change the game in a number of different ways. Now, I don't know. I've said this, too, about gambling. Like, gambling doesn't really affect – gambling doesn't affect me, and it doesn't affect a lot of people, because if you want to place a bet somewhere – it's almost impossible to not be able to place that
You can
bet.
Do that.
Like, you can do that pretty much anywhere. Yep. So it doesn't change. I don't think it's going to make things easier for an NBA player or an NBA referee to place a gamble, place a wager. But the league has to be kind of aware of the perception of them amongst some people is that they still are the league that allow Tim Donaghy to sneak through the cracks, and they have to be, you know, kind of aware of that.
And again, I think that's why – I know 1% doesn't seem like a lot, but when you start adding up, that's why they want that money. Again, I'm not going to discount the profit angle because that is part of it. But to have that kind of oversight and monitoring, you know, I'm not well-versed in it enough to know what happens to monitor that. But, you know, just based on reason and logic alone, there's going to take some pretty watchful eye, or it requires watchful eyes to pay attention to those kinds of things. And so some really hardened Vegas insiders, if you will, but people who really know gambling to figure out when something looks a little suspicious.
You just see a floor in the league office occupied by the, you know, these guys from Vegas that have been monitoring this stuff for years that the NBA brings in to be part of their staff.
A whole other idea of analytics right there. They're going to be looking at shot charts in a different way. Talk about player movement. You know, how much is a guy hustling in this game? Those are all things that they're going to take a look at. You know, if a guy covers, you know, 2.13 miles in a game, how come he only covered 1.1 mile in this game? I mean,
is he mailing it in?
Yes.
The extra passes that player X made, he made fewer in game one. Yeah, that's going to be hard, man.
Like, yeah, it really is.
And how do you ask those questions too? Like, do you go to a player and say, you know, is something funny? Do you ask for bank records? I mean, there's a lot of. This is why, you know, I think it's eventually going to get to the point where it's like crazy, where there is gambling in arenas, you know, any point in time during a game, you're going to be able to bet on something, but it might be years before we get there.
No, I think you're right about that at some point, Dan. You know, you mentioned, was it New Jersey probably going to be first on the list? I would say the broader view. I mean, we take a look at it, and it's obvious they're leaving it up right now to states' rights. I know the NBA would like federal rules to sort of run what states do, and I get that. But if you look a little bit about what some of the marijuana initiatives and laws have done around the country and has provided a boon to some of those economies, gambling's going to do the same for some of these states. And I think that's a significant reason why states are going to be more apt to put books in their states is because it's going to help out with the economy.
Should be interesting. Jeff, always appreciate the time, man. Know you were up late like me last night, and I'm sure we'll have a few more late nights here in Cleveland in our future. Thanks for joining me, man.
No, perfect, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Before I get to Pete Thamel, I got to tell my audience about a great new program at Full Sail University. This episode of the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast is brought to you by Full Sail University's Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting. Legendary sportscaster Dan Patrick, you know him from The Dan Patrick Show, Sunday Night Football, the Olympics, and SportsCenter, has teamed up with Full Sail University to offer an accelerated bachelor's degree in sportscasting. Full Sail University combines hands-on learning, immersive projects, and faculty with real-world experience to prepare students for life in the media industry. And for the Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting, they brought in some of sports media's best to be part of this program. Longtime ESPN producer and multi-Emmy winner Gus Ramsey is heading up the program, and sportscasting pros such as Sage Steele, Jay Harris, Bill Simmons, and many more are involved. Students will learn sportscasting inside and out, on camera, behind the camera, podcasting, radio, interviewing, and everything in between. At Full Sail University's Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting, you can earn a bachelor's degree in about half the time, as short as 20 months. And you can choose to earn your degree online or on Full Sail's campus in Orlando, Florida. To learn more about Full Sail University's Dan Patrick School of Sportscasting, go to fullsail.edu/Mannix. That's fullsail.edu/Mannix.
Up next, college basketball writer and NBA draft analyst at Yahoo, Pete Thamel. All right, joining me now on the podcast is my colleague over at Yahoo Sports, Pete Thamel, a senior college basketball writer. And we are recording this in front of many media members, Pete, that by the time this podcast is over, we'll probably be getting even more dirty looks than we get usually.
Yeah, I don't know if I'll get more here or out in the arena today.
Yes, so you're a popular guy amongst
the... It'll be competitive, yeah.
Yes, you're the guy walking around asking prospects if they've been contacted by the FBI.
It is relevant.
It is relevant. And John Calipari hanging out in the...
All the stars are shining in Chicago, Chris.
All the Frenzo Thamel are shining out there. All right, so before we get to some of the key storylines in this combine, I'm curious your thoughts on the relevance of the combine. My take on it, it's not always shared by others out, other executives there, but you have fewer and fewer players that are actively participating in the process. As big a media event as it's become, and we see the former Vertical broadcast team, now turned ESPN broadcast team.
Who? I don't recognize any of those guys.
Bobby Marks, Woj, Gavoni, Schmitz.
They're wearing earpieces like their Secret Service.
I know. It's something to see. But you know, there's wall-to-wall coverage of this event. There's almost 200 media members credentialed for this event. Yet it feels like it's less relevant than it's been in years past.
Are you trying to say there aren't good players?
Well, I mean, the 5-on-5 competition is you're not going to get any lottery picks.
No.
In that. I mean, what is the combine to you now?
So the combine to me now is like a convention where like they play pickup. I think that's really what it's evolved to, Chris. Like, if I'm an executive here, I'm looking for like second round picks for the most part. You know, late first, early second, those kinds of things. I thought it's been pretty telling that a lot of the guys you would actually come to the combine to see have decided not to participate in the combine. Mitchell Robinson tops that list for me. He's obviously just had a shadowy career. He played at a small high school in Louisiana, committed to Western Kentucky, where all blue chippers grow up dreaming to go, and left there, went back, left again in September, and then he kind of disappeared to Dallas and has worked out. Now, he's the kind of seven-footer who you'd wonder, can he compete against men? Can he compete in college? And he didn't even show up. Like, mm-hmm. He hasn't even done interviews yet. So I think there's been a collective eye roll about him from the NBA people that I've spoken to, Chris, just saying, okay, well, like, what's the point of the combine if you're going to hide the people you need to see from it? And then you go to Anfernee Simons, who's the very slight guard out of Florida who'd been committed to Louisville. Patino gets fired. He decommits. He's old enough, and he's in his fifth year of high school, prep school. He's a year removed from his graduating class. He goes pro. He's too small to compete against these older guys. I mean, if he's 19, these guys are 21, 22, but he's just very slender. He has like a tiny build. So there's thought he may go late first round, so they shut him down out of the 5-on-5. And then the biggest history guy is Billy Preston, who attended four different high schools, ever from Oak Hill Academy to API, which was in a strip mall in Dallas, a fine academic institution that no longer exists. Mm-hmm. And Billy Preston, along the way, has flashed some great talent. He also ended up in a superseding indictment the other day because allegedly Adidas helped pay a family member of his $90,000 to attend Kansas, and he never played a game there because of an NSA investigation. And so Billy Preston, who is a talented guy, he's kind of a 6'8 big who I've seen, and a lot of people have seen sporadically because he's such a good high school player, he doesn't show up. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I almost think the story is like who's not here as much as who's here from my perspective.
It bothers, you know, the media when the stars aren't out there participating and part of this process. It certainly bothers NBA types because they would like nothing more than to see, you know, 5-on-5s or doing all the drills and all the interview process. At the same time, history's kind of shown there isn't a lot of downside to skipping out on all this stuff, to, as you said, the mystery of it all, to creating it, because, you know, we can go down the list of guys that have not, you know, participated in this stuff, who have been drafted, who have made good money because of it.
Yeah. No, it's almost like the aura of mystery is of more value than the actual performance. I think that's kind of where we've come to here. You think back to Enes Kanter, for example, mm-hmm. came from Turkey, played at a reasonably high level there, never got eligible at Kentucky. And then
why was that?
Sort of because he had taken money to play professionally, Chris.
Who wrote that?
I think it was in the New York Times.
It was.
The time. Yeah.
I think, yes.
So, you know, you look back on guys like that. You go back to Mohamed Sané. Like, you know, just guys who flashed enough and have enough physical characteristics. And so they don't feel the need to compete. I don't really think any high-end foreign guys have ever competed that I can remember anyway. Just because you would rather have, you know, for especially for international players, that aura of mystery is of extreme value. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, now I know he's still playing over in Europe, but who wouldn't have loved to see Luka Doncic here? I mean, how can an unathletic guy, a guy who's like, that's a knock on him, be the number two pick in the NBA draft? That's mm-hmm. a little bit mind-boggling to me.
I think that, and look, there's a month to go before we get to the actual draft, but it is seemingly shaping up as 1-2 with Ayton and Doncic. You know, could it go the reverse? Yeah. Maybe. You know, obviously Phoenix with the number one pick. They've got a coach and a new coach there who is familiar with Doncic. They could use a swingman. They could use a lot of pieces in the Phoenix organization. Yeah. But, you know, from when you talk to people out in the gym, is that the sense you get too? Is that it's Ayton Doncic? Is there somebody else that could crash the party there?
Yeah, and you know, just because I come from the college space, I don't have as good of a feel for Doncic probably as you guys do, and then NBA world does. But that is certainly the consensus.
I don't think I'd be able to if he walked past us right now, except for the fact that he's about 6'7". I don't think I'd be able to recognize him.
Doesn't he have like a tattoo on his forearm?
Yeah, I usually check out the forearms,
like a shooting forearm. Yeah, that's a little helpful.
That should be done more for players. You know, like boxers say, like you should get the bottom of your shoes sponsored because I'm going to knock you out.
Yeah, it's going to be shown in there.
Like an NBA player, like maybe like the top of the wrist, like it's seen on TV.
Well, doesn't Curry have like a little tattoo right on?
But maybe
his
I'm
right
saying
wrist?
Sponsorship, like you know,
yeah,
could be like
imagine like the top of Steph Curry's palm on
GoldenPalace.com. Yeah. Like, you know, gambling's now being legalized. Anyway, but you know, but
that's how you can go make your fortune. Go hook up with a tattoo artist and start cashing in on your contract.
I'm surprised I haven't thought about it till this point. But at the top of the draft, with Ayton there, do you think is he to you the number one pick?
I don't even think it's close. I mean, if somebody like is, and if this is Ryan McDonough, God bless him, if somebody is brazen enough to look at a potentially generational talent like DeAndre, and when you look at the combination of size, athleticism, skill, and just the fact that, you know, I mean, I feel like in the last decade we've had like two Pantheon big men drafted, Anthony Davis and Karl Anthony Towns. Mm-hmm. Like those two to me, unless I'm missing someone glaring in your mind, like those are two, like I don't want to call them once a decade because I feel like we've kind of had two once a decade guys mm-hmm. in the last decade. But those two, and if you look at their production, obviously at the NBA level, have shown that. And I feel like Ayton is in that elite category of number one picks.
So he's that good. Okay. Yeah, I mean, if player like that, you can't pass with the number one pick.
No. I feel like, yeah, I mean, DeAndre Ayton's like he's like my grandmother could scout DeAndre Ayton and feel like he's going to be a top player in the draft. Now, there are flaws like the motor you saw. I mean, the Buffalo game certainly, you know, could bring some pause. And, you know, he struggled with physicality. I think he's a little bit immature. Mm. There's obviously, you know, he bounced around a bit in high school and had sort of a quintessentially tortured American high school basketball experience with shoe companies and AAU guys and all that stuff. But he does generally seem to be grounded. The Arizona staff raved about him during his time there. You saw his physical development at Arizona, Chris, really be as high-end as you can be. He had never really lifted weights and been in like a weight program, a nutrition program, etc. And if you look at the before and after of him physically from when he walked on campus there, there's an extreme amount of development, which will give you a lot of hope as an NBA franchise that he could make the same leap.
If it is Ayton and Doncic going 1-2, is there in your mind a consensus third? Because I talked to a couple of people and they said, look, the third pick might be the most difficult pick. Because if it's Ayton Doncic, and then who is it? I mean, there's probably three or four guys that could reasonably be expected to be in that mix.
Yeah, I'll be curious after we finish here in Chicago where Michael Porter is in people's mind.
Yeah.
A year ago at this time, if you had included him in the number one discussion, you know, nobody would have blinked. He obviously has some injuries, doesn't play much. At Missouri, comes back, and it's like a little bit awkward, and NBA people credited him for coming back, but maybe it hurt him because I was at his NCAA tournament game, and he just, quite frankly, wasn't 100%. He probably played at 70%. He didn't have explosion, he didn't have step, and he was winded. I mean, he just hadn't played, so he didn't have breath. Mm-hmm. So I feel like Porter's someone who can really help himself during this process, get back to where he was perceived to be a year ago. And I don't know. If I'm sitting at three, I have a hard time passing on Marvin Bagley. Mm-hmm. I just feel like his combination of size and skill is just so rare. Now, he can't guard this folding chair that's between us right now. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, Duke had to play zone because he was just such an atrocious defender. So that's a problem. But that said, like, you know, those guys like...
Okay, but is he, to stick with Bagley quickly, and I want to go back to Porter in a minute, but, you know, you say big man that can score is an atrocious defender. That reminds me of another Duke guy that came out a couple of years ago in Jahlil Okafor. Yeah. Big differences between the two players?
Do I think Okafor, I always thought, had like heavy feet and was a little sedentary. Mm. He clearly has gotten exposed as an awful defender. I just feel like Bagley's more of a stretch than Okafor was ever going to be. You know what I mean? Okafor, to me, was like a pure post, whereas Bagley runs like a deer. He may be like baseline to baseline as fast of a big man as we'll see run through here in a very long time. Mm. So I just think as athletes, they're very different people. And, I mean, who knows? I mean, so how much of defense is effort? How much of his skill? You know, like when it
Well, he's got to be mobile. Like, you make a good point on Okafor's feet. I mean, like, in today's NBA, you can count on one hand the number of immobile big men that are effective. I thought that one of the reasons Toronto, you know, got blitzed by Cleveland was because they play big men like Valanciunas, too much size. Sure. Like, size used to be a big thing in the NBA. Now it's how many 6'7", 6'8", wing players can I get?
Yeah, I just look at the Celtics, obviously. Both of us live in Boston, unfortunately. And, you've been able to see just what defensive versatility can do. And I almost feel like they're going to be the model of the new NBA that you're talking about. Like, when Greg Monroe's on the floor, it looks like he's, like, calcified. Mm-hmm. You know, when you compare it to the big guys like Brown and Tatum, who can switch everything and really play in a much more concise style.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Milwaukee, same thing. Using a lot of length. Those two teams are going to be the model. All right. But I want to ask you about Porter. And again, most of the people listening to this podcast didn't get a good look at this kid. But what was the perception of him coming into his college season? Did you see him on the same level as some of these other top guys?
Absolutely. And I just think him taking the dip because of the injury I really feel like this is one of the best draft classes of my lifetime, just in terms of the high-end quality bigs. Mm-hmm. This is an anomalous assembly of high-end quality bigs where we maybe haven't had that, you know, in other years. Like, you could go back through three or four different drafts the last decade where Michael Porter would have been the number one pick. Mm-hmm. When you look at, you know, just some of the how some of these drafts have unfolded. And, you know, Mo Bamba is a really tantalizing prospect. Now, he's going to be 3-4 years down the line, but his timing on his shot blocking and people who played against him consistently in the Big 12, like, he's of the mode and of the build, and he's that modern big man who can switch everything. And his reach is like some kind of just outlandish numbers that they handed to us yesterday. Mm-hmm.
But Porter had that talent.
Oh, yes. He's a shooter, Chris.
Shooter. You look at an NBA players. Is there a comparable sort of talent?
You know, like, some people reference a little bigger Penny Hardaway with him.
Okay.
When, you know, like, and again, Penny Hardaway is obviously a very good player. I don't know if he's a Hall of Famer or not, but, you know, he's clearly a...
Might have been if he stayed healthy. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. So that was one. I did something on Porter after they lost in the NCAA tournament in Nashville, and that was one of the comps that that came up. So, no, don't be surprised if he sneaks in that 3-4 range. Jaren Jackson is the flavor of the moment now around 4, but I really feel like he may be a bit of that heavier footed defender than we see, and he can shoot, but he is not the shooter of Porter. I think a really interesting guy, Chris, is going to be Jonte Porter. I'm expecting Jonte Porter to stay in the draft, Michael Porter's little brother, and I think he'll be a great value for a smart team in the 20s. You got to remember, he was just supposed to be a senior in high school this past season. He reclassified to go play with his brother, and he was one of the better players in the SEC when it all came down to it this year. So I feel like if you're a patient franchise like the Spurs or the Celtics or someone sitting there late in the first round, you can take Jonte Porter, redshirt him essentially for a year. I don't know if he'll ever quite be Michael Porter, but he's the kind of guy where, you know, back in the day, if he'd gone to college the right year and spent 2 years there, you know, he'd been a top 10 pick. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no reason he couldn't be in that, like, sort of Bridges category, Miles Bridges, Mikhail Bridges, that type of a player, if given another year.
Two things I've been hearing about Michael Porter. One is real, the other might be bullshit. You know, the back stuff. Like, teams are obviously going to take a long look at his medicals to see if that back is going to be problematic or chronic later in his career. Now, Porter's been saying the right things in front of the media here, saying doctors have told him he's fine, like, everything, full system, all systems go, but that's something that's going to be scrutinized. The other part of it is that I've been hearing some whispers that his interviews haven't been going well, that he hasn't interviewed all that well. Now, that could be bullshit because I think there are teams that are sitting there in the 6 to 10 range that are hoping that he falls to them.
Sure.
That, you know, and that there is going to be, I think, some poisoning of the waters around mm-hmm. Michael Porter over the next month, because I think teams that are in the back half of the lottery are going to see Michael Porter as yeah. a top three pick that sure. could slide to them because of all his issues.
Yeah. So back in March, when I kind of polled NBA guys about him, he was a little bit of a divisive prospect. The word soft came up a few times. Now, again, some of that's from the limited glimpses NBA guys get of him, which is like all-star games, McDonald's practices, Hoop Summit kind of stuff. He has never been a particularly engaged or willing defender, but he's also always been the number one player in his whole class. So a lot of times those guys just aren't like that. But I do remember, defensive indifference came up again. Maybe not to the Bagley length, but still there. But I do think he has a really nice frame. Like when you, I don't know how much you saw of him yesterday or today out there, Chris. But like when you look at him, you can easily translate with your eyes how he can be like. Again, nobody's going to shoot it like Jason Tatum did his rookie year. But if I had to do a comp of who he's like, I would think that's like that type of a player, a pure shooting, versatile big man. Now Tatum's handle to me has been really the thing that surprised me, and the thing we maybe didn't see as much at Duke, where they did a remarkable job of almost hiding him in a sense. Yeah. Brad has not hit him in Boston, but I do think Porter is that type of a modern NBA player. And some guys you worry about because you're like, well, wait a minute, what does he become in the NBA? Who is his comparison? I don't have a problem doing that with Michael Porter.
You mentioned Duke, and one of the few seniors that's here is Grayson Allen, someone I wrote about last week. He's clearly athletic.
Yeah.
One thing you see in all his drills is he's one of the best athletes in Chicago. He's clearly competitive. I mean, some of the people that have watched him go through this talk about just how kind of relentless he is, even in sure. these drills. And that's what we saw in college basketball. But two questions about him. First, what kind of player is he? He's not J.J. Redick. That's a different type of player.
No.
He's not Jimmer Fredette either. That's yeah. a different type of player.
Yes.
Who is, Grayson Allen at this point?
So he's like, I'm just trying to think of NBA comps off the top of my head.
Well, let me be specific.
Is he TJ McConnell, Chris? Is that like a feisty, fiery, change of pace guard?
But Grayson's got size and more athleticism than McCollum did.
Sure. So do you.
Do you think, that's true. Do you think Grayson's a point guard? That's the question I think that
I
is
don't,
divided.
To be honest with you. He's some kind of combo guard. He's sort of like the modern guard now. He is not a pure in the like Jock Vaughn sense of a guy who's going to come in and run the point. But
it's tremendous. Jock Vaughn reference.
Yeah, thank you. We're trying. We're trying.
Okay. Jock Vaughn, the quintessential pure point guard.
No, I meant like this is like eighth man backup yes. point guard type thing.
Gotcha.
I don't think Grayson Allen is ever going to start in the NBA. I'm modest about his NBA potential, I guess. Mm-hmm. I think he's intriguing. I can understand why you may have written about him because, I've heard that people are very interested in him and may click on stories about
little
him.
A little bit.
Yeah,
little
for,
bit.
For some reason. I have a hard time conjuring up comps for him. I feel like the last couple of years in the NBA, there's been, I call it like the Malcolm Brogdon effect. Like guys are super productive players for 4 years, slip to the second round, and then become like immediately productive players because they're old, they're big, they're experienced. And this is an odd concept, but they're like good at playing basketball. Mm-hmm. And I feel like this combine is almost now like identifying those guys as much as it is identifying like franchise guys or starters. I guess Brogdon is a starter, but those kinds of things. And I wonder when we're going to see a paradigm shift in the choosing of players to production instead of potential. And he's a guy who could come in and potentially be one of those older productive guys. I don't know if he's one that I would choose immediately, but you could certainly make a case for it. And I do No, just some chat with scouts around here. NBA teams are intrigued by him. There's no doubt.
I think there's a wide disparity between how teams see him.
Yes.
I had one team executive say they like him in the late teens.
Wow.
I had another say 25 to 35. A couple said second round.
Yeah.
You hate to keep using that phrase value pick, but he could wind up being one of those guys. The question is, and I think he's going to have to answer these questions moving forward, is what kind of person is he? The tripping stuff. All the cheap shots, that is very readily available to teams.
It's like a lower grade Tebow effect.
Yeah.
Like, can he just blend in? Does he become this like viral distraction? I think he'll be fine. I think he could go be the 11th guy and some far-flung NBA city and just sort of, you know, if he's on the Bulls, like, just be a backup and play a role. He's a winner. You know, there's no doubt about that. And, like, I think some of these executives, like, you look at a guy like Danny Ainge, and, you know, one thing, as these Celtics have been constructed, he's valued that, like, competitive edge because he himself was a very competitive, fiery player who wasn't afraid of confrontation. So I think some of these executives may see that twitch that where he's pushed over the line and almost see it as an advantage 82 games a year as opposed to some of these coddled AAU guys who just are sort of apathetic
competitively. They like guys in Boston with chips on their shoulder. I mean, they were all in on Isaiah Thomas early on because they knew he had that chip. And if you get on the roster, Terry Rozier, another guy that...
Marcus Smart.
Like, yeah, you've got a whole bunch of guys there. All right, anybody else that you have seen or talked to people about here at the Combine? This is, like, the real stuff happens in the next... People listening, the real stuff happens in the next month when agent workouts take place and all these top guys work out, when individual workouts happen and guys start going up against each other, when guys like Grayson Allen and others start traveling across the country to work out for these teams. So there's a long way to go, but, you know, anybody else have a little bit of buzz that you've...
You know, a couple people I've talked to have really liked Jerome Robinson, who I've seen a lot. He's a guard out of Boston College. He was the second leading vote getter for ACC Player of the Year. Oh, man, I didn't even know I'm giving red meat to the Mannix family, for crying out loud.
Let's go Eagles.
Yeah. And, you know, he's slight and a little bit undersized, but I just think when you want to talk about, like, the Malcolm Brogdon effect, like, if you want someone who could step in and be productive right away, like, you can't argue with the numbers he put up. I don't think he's a great defender. He, again, slides into that combo role a little bit where you have to do a little projecting. But I just think, you know, he has a discernible skill, and it's shooting and scoring. And I feel like that could translate and really help him.
I think he should go back to school and continue to make Boston College great again.
Yes. I have a feeling Boston College may be mediocre again with him gone. So Kai Bowman better go back or Andy Mannix is going to be asked to revive his eligibility.
Let me finish with this. A guy you wrote about last week, Brian Bowen, who you've written about a little bit because of his getting caught up in the FBI investigation. You watched him on Thursday. I watched him a little bit on Friday and wasn't impressed with what I saw. Just kind of looked lost out there amongst the prospects. Didn't stand out at all. But he's going to have problems. I mean, he's kind of in limbo, isn't he?
He is. You know, the best thing that's happened to him here is the interview he did. I thought he came off really well yesterday. I thought he came off as poised and mature. And in speaking to teams who interviewed him, they really felt like he came off as a sympathetic figure. He didn't try to. They just sort of there was a genuineness about him that people liked. They didn't feel like they were being conned by a guy who like took the money. So I feel like on the ground level, people like him and are intrigued by him, like him personally and are intrigued by him. He's just a guy who should be in college 3 years. Like, he was not a one and done. Nobody cast him as a one and done when he was coming out of high school in Michigan or at La La Mer, the prep school in Indiana. And the reason why there was so much buzz about him was because his handlers basically, very wisely, he was basically the only unsigned McDonald's All-Americans guy, and they waited, and moved up the market. And as the federal charging documents show, the market ended up being $100,000 for him. But he was not like a top 10 prospect. He really wasn't a top 20 prospect. And, you know, he's a really, really good shooter, and he brings a lot of positive things to the table. But he doesn't do anything well enough at this point right now. Where, you know, an NBA team's going to waste any time on him. You know, he's a developmental G League guy, like a guy who has to develop into a G League player. He's a few years away, so could he go overseas? I don't ever think 19-year-olds should go overseas, just because you're playing against men. Now, certainly the coaching overseas is excellent, like often much better than, you know, a lot of spots in the American system. But, yeah, no, he's really in a tough spot. I do not think the NCAA will ever rule him eligible. I mean, it would be a really hard look for an organization that's getting pummeled from every direction right now to just let a kid play whose family took $100,000. That doesn't set a great precedent. That would make like Cam Newton look like his family was asking for pocket change. So in that sense, yeah, Brian Bowen's in an unideal spot right now. And I don't think there's like a good answer there for what's next. But I would expect him to go professional only because the NCAA has given no indication that they're going to allow him to play. He's since transferred to South Carolina, so that's where he is right now. I don't ever think we'll see him in a Gamecock uniform.
And going overseas, unless you're committed to that team long term, coaches aren't going to play you. They're just not. Like, even if you're someone that's you know, from that country or from that area, if they think you're going to go to the NBA, they're not going to invest the time in you.
Yes.
It's never going to happen.
Yeah.
Unless you're LiAngelo Ball. Maybe they'll...
Yes.
Maybe he'll be a long-time
yeah.
member of somebody.
Did he get invited? Oh, no, he didn't get invited.
He's not
here.
Out yeah. here.
Do you think that's been mismanaged, Chris?
I think perhaps.
Yeah.
I think maybe staying at UCLA, taking your punishment, and then figuring out if you're an actual NBA talent.
Yeah.
And if not, maybe you can, you know, get a sports management degree and become like the Cooper Manning of your family. Like, I mean, which is nothing wrong with that. Like,
no.
you could become the agent of the family.
Yeah.
I just think that it just ends badly for LiAngelo playing yeah. some in some far flung nondescript country or in, you know, his father's fledgling league that
yeah.
is allegedly going to happen here. I don't know.
Yeah, you have to be better than your problems. Lonzo is better than his problems because
yes.
he was the number two pick in the draft and is, you know, maybe the best passer I've seen come through college basketball in my mm-hmm. time covering it. The rest of them are not going to be better than their problems because their problems got bigger once Lonzo hit the NBA
mm-hmm.
and Facebook deals and yeah, just yeah. It's actually been a quiet year on the ball front because I think they may now realize how badly he's messed everything up.
Yeah, I wonder. I wonder if it's that or the fact that he was overseas and not a lot of media kind of went over there and followed him. Does the summertime bring a whole new, you know, set of media firestorms that are out there now that he's back? I mean, I have a hard time seeing this ever evolving story being over.
Yeah, I don't think it'll ever end because yeah. it is just a consummate sideshow. And again, people click on it, so people are going.
That they do.
Yeah, people are going to follow it. But at the end of the day, I'm perfectly apathetic towards it now because mm-hmm. I don't think there's any more relevant balls coming through the pipeline.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you. All right, Pete, you're going to be a big part of our draft coverage coming up next month. We'll reveal a lot of that down the line. But thanks for joining me here.
Chris, thanks for having me.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Jeff Zilgit and Pete Thamel for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you could download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.